Today is Thursday, January 31st, 2019. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Our first case on the calendar today is A-17-0422, State of Minnesota versus DeArius Calvin Collins. Counsel, I think both of you know the procedure that we have. 15 minutes for appellant, followed by 15 minutes by respondent state, and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please, when you approach the podium, feel free to adjust it for your height. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Please, the court. Counsel, my name is Charles Clippert. I'm appearing on behalf of the appellant, DeArius Collins. Mr. Collins was convicted of it was a 20-count conviction for a shooting off the Earl Street Bridge in St. Paul. The state alleged that it was a gang retaliation matter. And the state's theory of the case was that Mr. Collins was in the back seat as the person who actually fired the bullets out the window. The other person in the car who was convicted was a guy named Demetrius Moore. There was a passenger in the car, a front seat passenger named Tyree Beecham, who apparently was never prosecuted for this matter. So there's a couple things that are, I think, worth pointing out onto this case that may help the court give it some perspective. After the shooting, there was very little information about who was involved. There was no witnesses. They weren't able to identify anybody involved until two young women came forward and said, I know the car that was involved in this, and Tyree Beecham is, you know, bragging about being the shooter in this case. Based on that information, the police did some initial investigation, follow-up, confirmed some of these details, and got search warrants for Moore's car, Beecham's house, and that really is what broke open the case. And the interrogation of Beecham, I think, is really important or interesting because the police officers, they do an initial questioning of Beecham and Moore, and they both, those individuals, say, I don't know what happened. The police returned to talk to Beecham, and the officer explained to Beecham, look, you can either be a shooter or you can be a witness. The best place to be in this situation is the passenger in the car. And Beecham then testifies that he's the passenger in the car, and says Collins is in the back seat and Demetrius Moore is the driver. Mr. Moore goes to trial first and is convicted. While his case is pending sentencing, the state compels him to testify with a grant of immunity, and then Moore does in fact testify against Collins during the trial. And that, I think, is one of the issues I'd like to start with, is this whole idea that the prosecutor can call a witness that they have just said is not credible in a trial before and then say, well, you know, he's credible.
But that credibility issue went to specific testimony that is not, well, first of all, I think parties agree generally his testimony was consistent between the two trials. But what we're talking about is specific testimony that they're relying on in this case.
Right. And his testimony, big picture, was consistent in both trials. I grant you that. But it's some of the details that he filled in that I think were compelling that didn't come up in the first trial and didn't come up in any prior statements either. For example, he was interviewed twice and never said, Collins put a gun to my neck and I could feel it was warm. In the first two interviews, Moore never was able to identify the gun that was involved. But by the time he comes to trial in Collins' case, he's able to say, well, it's a 9mm high point and I recognize it because my uncle's got one. So those are, I think, fairly compelling facts that bolster Moore's credibility and point toward Collins as being the shooter, where the theory in trial was that Beecham was the shooter.
So are those facts you think makes this different than Pendleton? Because I must say, I know the state relied upon Pendleton. When I went and looked at it, it seemed to be pretty on point.
Right, and Pendleton actually, first of all, was framed as a professional conduct issue rather than a due process issue. But the holding in Pendleton is actually really interesting because it's a very similar case in that they called a witness who the state didn't believe, but Pendleton was saved because the state offered very narrow testimony about what they believed to be true that Morris Pendleton testified to. I think it was three or four facts. And I think had the state here said, called Moore and said, okay, Mr. Moore, were you driving over the Earl Street Bridge on this night? Yes. Was Collins in the car with you? Yes. Did he fire a gun at a group of people? Yes. That's clearly Pendleton and I wouldn't be here. But because the state got to basically go well beyond what they think is the theory of the case, that's what brings in the, it distinguishes this from Pendleton and I think causes the NAPU violation.
But as with any credibility determination, aren't juries instructed that they can believe some or all or none of a person's testimony, and it may, you know, that they may be, that there may be credible evidence or credible testimony for some aspects of the case and not for others?
Sure.
I mean, isn't that a cardinal principle of assessing credibility?
Sure, but also the state has an affirmative duty to inform the jury of testimony they know to be false at the time it's given. And here, the state relies on the fact that the prosecutor said in closing arguments, Moore was clearly minimizing, but in the closing arguments, the judges instruct the jury to say, the statements of the lawyers aren't evidence. So what the prosecutor was required to do after Moore testified to say, instruct the jury, look, these are the facts that we believe that Moore testified to truthfully. I want you to disregard anything else. That was how the prosecutor would have fulfilled their obligations.
Counsel, you mentioned the fact of the gun type and that it had been pointed at him and that he noted that it was still warm, and that was testimony that was not in his trial but did come up in appellant's trial. For that, why is that so significant? I think it's a rather interesting point, but I'm not sure the significance of it and why it actually works against the state, because is that information, wasn't that a line of questioning that came up specific to who the shooter was and what happened with respect to the shooter, whereas with the earlier trial, that wasn't as much of an issue there.
That's a valid point, and I think the problem we have is that Moore is trying to really minimize his involvement. He's trying to say, look, I'm merely present. I was just driving the car. I didn't even know the gun was fired in the car. And then he goes on to say this other stuff for Collins sort of intimidating him and trying to threaten him, and I think is an excuse to further demonstrate his minimization or explain why he wasn't affirmatively calling the police or acting to help the investigation. So I see your point, but I also think, again, when I read that in the transcripts, I thought, that is a point that really hit home, because, the guy's talking about, the barrel of the gun was to my neck and I could feel it was still warm. I mean, just recently fired. I thought that was fairly a compelling line of testimony.
Well, in assessing, whether this witness should be allowed to go ahead or not, in this case, wasn't the jury advised via the testimony of Mr. Moore that he had already been found guilty?
Sure.
And at his trial? So whatever he testified to minimizing his role in the incident had already been rejected by a jury. Isn't that sufficient to satisfy any state's obligation to not produce false testimony? Because with all of that testimony, you have to have the jury obviously assess how reliable that testimony is anyway.
Right, I guess the jury was told that he was convicted. They really didn't know what he was convicted of. And second of all, NAPU makes it really specific as to what the prosecutor's obligations are. They need to advise the jury of what they know to be false testimony at the time that's offered. And by saying he's convicted of the crime doesn't necessarily mean, well, the jury rejected his testimony. That doesn't quite get there.
But he himself said they already found me guilty. I think I'm quoting
correct
from him.
Right.
So he that Mr. Moore, as the witness, advised the jury of that.
Right.
I mean, why isn't that sufficient?
Because I guess I have to go back to the holding in NAPU, which, again, it says that it's the state's obligation to inform the jury of testimony that they believe to be false. And by just saying, well, he's convicted of this, and, you know, that doesn't get you there.
But you have someone who minimized his role, did so at a prior trial, and then said, based on the jury's verdict, they found me guilty.
Right.
So obviously rejecting the minimization, what more should the state do? I mean, doesn't that, do they have to make a declaration? We think this is false. I mean, isn't that kind of beating a dead horse there? Because he's already said the jury rejected it. They found me guilty.
I think the obligation on NAPU is to advise the jury of the testimony that they believe is false. Or they could probably satisfy it by saying, this is what we believe is credible out of Moore's testimony, that he was driving, that Collins was in the back seat of the car, and that Collins shot at the group.
Okay,
of people.
My question is, when should the state advise the jury of that?
The NAPU says at the time the testimony is given.
So it's not sufficient to do to close. I mean, I certainly understand the admonition by and the jury instruction saying comments by counsel at beginning or opening are not testimony, but why isn't that sufficient? Because the state was made it pretty clear that he's minimizing his role, and it seems to me that statement there, the state was trying to put into context what was truthful, what Moore's testimony was truthful, and what was not, and what they really should be focusing on. Why isn't that sufficient? Because that is really an opportunity for the state to address the jurors.
Right. But I guess I have to go back to the holding in NAPU, which says the state has got to advise the jury at the time of the testimony.
Right. I understand that. My point is, is that the only way? Does NAPU say that the only time that can be done is at the time of testimony? Let me rephrase it another way. Does NAPU preclude the opportunity for the state to do it during closing arguments?
I have not seen anything that says the state satisfies this by doing a closing argument. I've not seen anything. To your point, no. But I also think there's a difference between saying Moore is minimizing versus saying we believe this testimony or parts of his testimony are false too. Minimizing is it's sort of a nice way of saying he's lying, but he's without saying he's lying. What I think you have to say, he's lying, and this is what we don't believe. And again, Your Honor, I haven't seen something that says NAPU can only be satisfied by making that admonition at the time the testimony comes in. So, but I guess if there had been a stronger declaration from the prosecutor at closing, then that may have helped minimize the violation. If I could just jump ahead to the issue with the CRI, because I think that's actually kind of an interesting flip of the coin of the issue we were just talking about, because in the CRI part of this case, the state precluded, or the judge precluded, the testimony of these two CRIs who said Beecham was bragging about the shooting because of a Dexter violation. They apparently had recanted their testimony by the time their time to testify came. And I guess if you're talking about fundamental fairness in being able to present a defense, if the government's going to bring witnesses before, you know, cop comes in, swears, I believe this testimony in this search warrant, and a judge signs off on it. It seems to me that that's a pretty strong validation of that testimony.
Well, and you'll agree it's hearsay, right?
It's hearsay, but it's whether it follows under the catch-all exception.
All right. And the first element of the catch-all exception is that the statement has some circumstantial guarantees of trustworthiness.
Sure.
And if they recanted the statement, how can that have those guarantees of trustworthiness? If they said we lied or this isn't right,
It's almost that the recantation was so bad because they said we didn't even talk to the cops. They didn't know anything about that. Well, we know that that was the information that was provided from the police officer about Beecham's role. And that's part of the problem I see here is that if a jury is supposed to be the one to assess the credibility of the witnesses, wouldn't it be appropriate for these witnesses to come in to testify in front of the jury and be given a chance to say, hey, it wasn't me, and then be confronted with this report for the jury to really assess as to whether who's credible.
So, and I understand what you're saying about shouldn't it be reliable if they was relied upon by the state to get to originally? But one of the things that troubled me, and I just wanted to give you the opportunity to address it, was the way I read what the CRI said was it wasn't they heard Beecham bragging about this, but they heard somebody saying Beecham had been bragging about it, which seems to be double hearsay upon hearsay.
Sure.
Really troubled me about the reliability.
Right. And obviously there's a different standard for getting a search warrant as probable cause, but it still seems that that met the threshold of reliability given all the other information that was confirmed during their investigation. So that's why we'd ask for the conviction to be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Clippert. The state will have 15 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Peter Marker, representing the state. I want to focus on the second issue as well, just because I think that is the issue that's in front of you that for which there is the least amount of guidance, frankly. And I would encourage the court to think about this issue in sort of two separate pieces. There is sort of the false testimony claim, kind of that NAPU claim, NAPU versus Illinois claim. This is not a NAPU claim. That claim requires the prosecutor to have personal knowledge that a statement is false. And the classic example of that in NAPU and in every case that follows from that is where the defendant lies or the witness lies about the deal that he or she got from the government. The prosecutor is obviously uniquely positioned to know that that is a false statement, right? And so NAPU requires the prosecutor to correct that statement. Now, the prosecutor doesn't have personal knowledge in the situation like this that what Moore is saying on the stand is false. The prosecutor doesn't believe all of it, but that happens all the time, right? And so the prosecutor wasn't on the bridge, doesn't have personal knowledge, and so there is no constitutional obligation to correct testimony that the prosecutor doesn't necessarily find to be credible. I mean, that's almost asking for the prosecutor to vouch for a witness, which prosecutors obviously are prohibited from doing. And so that's the first bucket. This is just not a NAPU situation. Prosecutors just don't know that this information is false. The second aspect of this claim, I think, is the one that's squishier, and that comes from Pendleton, sort of the Pendleton piece of it. I was the one that brought Pendleton into this case. It was my case 10 years ago, and because I think it has the most parallels here, because it arises the question, if the prosecutors challenge the credibility of a witness or a defendant in a prior proceeding, what is their obligation as to that testimony in this proceeding? And Pendleton takes the position, and Chief Justice Magnuson in that case took the position that, look, this isn't a quote false testimony situation because the state offered very narrow testimony. They only offered the testimony that the state believed to be true. And the testimony here with regard to Moore is, as counsel fairly knows, a little bit broader. And so but it has the same effect of Pendleton for several reasons, which I'd like to go through. First of all, this is not a situation where the prosecutors were questioning the credibility of the testimony in the first proceeding and then turning around and arguing that it was credible in the second proceeding. We just don't have that here. As Judge Merrick noted, the state's position has never changed in this proceeding, in these two proceedings, the Moore and the Collins proceedings. Secondly, the prosecutor in this case specifically told the jury, as the court knows and as it's spelled out in our briefs, that, look, Moore is minimizing what his involvement was. And, we know that's true. Thirdly, the jury was specifically given an accomplice instruction as to Moore. The jury was told Moore is an accomplice. Therefore, anything that he says must be corroborated. There must be some corroboration. That's the accomplice instruction. Of course, the nature of the accomplice instruction is, the reason it exists is because accomplices lie. The law recognizes that. And so we ask jurors to consider whether that testimony is corroborated. And here, that instruction was specifically given as to Moore. And in fact, as the court has noted, the jury knew that he had been convicted of these very crimes. So not only did the prosecutor indicate to the jury that he was minimizing, the jury knew that Moore's jury had already convicted him. And further, the evidence in this case, Collins' case, sort of reestablished Moore's liability as an accomplice. I mean, Chester Wilson Spencer, who was the state's primary lay witness, he was one of the victims on the bridge, specifically identified Moore as the driver and sort of offering this menacing look to the group as he was driving over the bridge and then turning around, establishing independently, or at least going a long way towards establishing independently Moore's liability in this very case. And finally, my final point on this is Sergeant Cheshire's testimony about he was one of the investigators who interviewed these guys several times, and his testimony was that, look, you know, we thought Moore was minimizing his involvement from the beginning. That was just our belief based on the circumstances. So we have all of these variables, at least five variables coming together, showing that the state is not promoting all of his minimization to the jury. They put him up there to establish that he was the driver and that Collins was the shooter. Could they have done that with a half dozen questions? Probably. But I'm not aware of any case that says that it's a due process violation not to do that. And most importantly, the state just didn't take inconsistent positions with regard to that testimony.
Mr. Marker, before you move to the other issues, let me ask you this. I don't want to take lots of your time on this with this question, given, just the many serious issues we have in this case. But you said that this is the area where there is the least amount of guidance around these NAPU Pendleton type issues. Is this the sort of thing we should consider, whatever our decision is in this case, publication of the case? Do you have an opinion upon that? And I would ask Mr. Clibbert if you have an opinion. Obviously, I'd like to hear that too.
I think it would perhaps be helpful. I guess I don't see what happened here as a common problem because all of the protections are in place. I mean, we just don't have situations very often that I'm aware of where the state is taking inconsistent positions in the same case from trial to trial. And again, you have the accomplice instruction to the jury that's so important. By the way, Beecham the same instruction was given for Beecham in this case. And in, you have the jury's knowledge that he had been convicted of the same crimes. I think that you certainly could publish, but I think that in effect, what happened here is consistent with what happened in Pendleton. It was done a little bit differently, but the effect is the same as Pendleton because you don't have the state taking contrary positions. And Judge Merrick, before I move on from this issue quickly, Judge Merrick made the point that there is no, I'm quoting now, there is no requirement that the state accept all of a witness's testimony. It is free to argue that parts are true and parts are not. And that is fundamentally true, right? I mean, the jury is the evaluator of the credibility of witnesses. The state cannot vouch for the credibility of the witness, but it can certainly argue for the credibility of the witness, and it can argue against the credibility of a witness, and certainly do both of those things within the same testimony.
And you're getting into a question I was going to ask you. I mean, what's the line between the state coming forward saying this is a false statement and vouching? I mean, are we getting into possible misconduct if the state makes, about when it's truly a credibility issue?
Well, what we know, Your Honor, is that the state is prohibited, prosecutor is prohibited from getting up and saying, look, I believe this witness. And we know the prosecutor can't do that. But the prosecutor can certainly argue all day long as to why a witness is credible or not credible based on the evidence. And that's what was done here. And the prosecutor's argument here was focused on the fact that Moore was the driver, which was never in dispute, and that Collins was the shooter, and that the evidence supported that conclusion. Moore's minimization of his own involvement is not only predictable, it's really unimportant here, because it had very little... little to do with Collins' theory of the case, which was that Beecham was the shooter. He didn't identify Moore as the shooter. So,
Counsel, before you move on, I just have one more quick question. Wouldn't this be a non-issue in this case if the testimony from Moore solely focused on whether or not Collins was the shooter?
It would be cleaner, I think, Your Honor. I think that's true. My point is that's the effect of the testimony, because beyond the pieces of Moore's testimony to which the state ascribed, that he was the driver and Collins was the shooter and Beecham was a passenger, the rest of Moore's testimony was not only lacked importance, but it was minimized not only by the prosecutor, but also by the other evidence and by the instructions and by the fact that the jury knew that he had already been convicted. So I think all of those things together reach the same conclusion that we have in Pendleton. But they certainly could have asked fewer questions, and that might be a better practice. But I don't think there's not a case that I've seen that establishes that that's a due process violation. Now, had the state taken different positions, I mean, had the state all of a sudden argued in Collins' case that Moore was credible on every aspect of his testimony, that's a different question. And I frankly don't know the answer to that. I haven't seen a case that talks about that circumstance. But that just didn't happen here. I think that's where the difference is. And maybe that will happen in a future case, hopefully not, but it didn't happen here. I'll move on to issue three because that's what Mr. Clippert did, just quickly. I don't have a lot to say on that issue that's not in my brief, other than to reemphasize, I guess, that the question of probable cause for a search warrant and the admissibility of evidence are completely different issues. I mean, police officers and signing judges rely on things for probable cause that a lot of times never become admissible at trial. So whether something establishes probable cause, it's not a question of admissibility. It's a question of circumstances, probable cause, totality of the circumstances. Had these two witnesses who made the statements that supported the police's probable cause, had they maintained their positions, then certainly they would have been allowed to be called. But the fact that they recanted their statements, which again is not an unusual circumstance at all, we run into Dexter. And the law is very well established. You simply may not call a witness in order for the sole purpose of impeaching them with a prior statement unless that statement is otherwise admissible under the hearsay rules. And that law is quite clear. And so this is clearly a Dexter problem. Judge Merrick identified it as a Dexter problem, and she evaluated it exactly the way that she should have. Okay, the statements that you want to introduce, are they otherwise admissible under the rules of hearsay? And she concluded that they weren't because they were not reliable enough to meet the residual exception to hearsay rule. And as Your Honor pointed out, there are double hearsay concerns with it. So that ruling was well within the court's discretion. I'm out of time, and I thank you for your time. I ask that you affirm the conviction.
Thank you, Ms. Markett. Mr. Clippert, 5 minutes.
I guess I disagree with Mr. Marker's position that the state hasn't taken a contradictory positions. If you look at the state's closing argument in the Moore's trial, the prosecutor argued, you heard Ms. Bax asked him Moore, didn't you promise on your own children's soul that you weren't lying when in fact he was over and over again? That seems to me to be a pretty strong statement that the government thought Moore was lying. So I question Mr. Markert's position is that the state is taking inconsistent positions, because I think they are. I think there's significant parts of Moore's testimony that the state doesn't believe that they offered and failed to correct. So I do think there's a NAPU violation. And I disagree also that the state has to be in a position where the prosecutor personally knows. I mean, that would put a NAPU violation almost circumstances that just don't make any sense. So I think if a witness comes in and is interviewed 3 times and for the first time mentions something that would be unusual, like, hey, it was a 9 millimeter high point gun that was involved, and I know it because of my uncle, it certainly seems to be a lie, and that should have been corrected by the prosecutor because of all the interactions they had with this.
But that seems to be, the state's position seems to make common sense, though, that why should a prosecutor correct statements that it doesn't know for sure really are indeed false? I mean, things that the prosecutor has personal knowledge of, like plea deals or sentence received or factual information that is pretty clear, it seems appropriate that the state should be responsible for clarifying those issues. But ones that go to credibility or testimony, those seem to be much squishier, and unless you've got that seems to be a more logical approach.
I guess that's what I'm saying is there shouldn't be a hard and fast rule that would be the prosecutor's got to be the witness to the false testimony, because I think there's going to be circumstances where a prosecutor knew or should have reason to know that a witness is testifying falsely based on what other evidence they know about the case. And that would trigger their obligation to correct the false testimony. So again, if you have an investigator who's run ballistics on a gun and knows that a certain gun is excluded, and a witness is testifying, hey, I've shot this with a revolver, when the ballistic shows it was an automatic, that could trigger
That seems to be more hard evidence, whereas what we're talking about here in terms of testimony, in terms of what happened, the involvement, who did what, that That seems like information that the prosecutor is not necessarily going to know whether or not that's true or not. That seems like that determination is up to the jury to determine what is credible. But in particular, when you look at the fact that a witness, an accomplice, that testimony is almost by definition is presumed to be false unless there's some type of corroboration which the jury can point to show and the state can present to show that that testimony, in fact, is true. Here we have the corroboration of Moore's testimony by Beecham that Collins was the shooter.
Right. I guess I'd just point out that the prosecutor in their closing argument and Moore again pointed out that they didn't believe Moore because the first time he said he spat at the exact time he made eye contact with Chester was when he testified, and that never came up in any interview. And they called into Moore his credibility based on the fact that this testimony came up for the first time. So I guess that's the standard that the state's using to discredit witnesses. Shouldn't something similar or the same kind of measurement apply here? So I don't concede that there's the state isn't taking two different positions about the.
You know, but how does the state? I mean, because as I view the statement that was made by this witness, is my position is I really didn't know what was going on, blah blah blah. So he's telling from his standpoint what his position is. He hasn't even been sentenced yet. The testimony develops that a jury's already found that to be incredible because they found him guilty. I guess how does a prosecutor go any further? I mean, first of all, why is that a false statement? Because he's saying what his position was. He hasn't even been sentenced. He may, you know, there may be an appeal. I don't know. But how can the prosecutor become involved here, vouching one way or the other without getting into some misconduct?
Well, and I agree with Mr. Marker that what should have happened here would have been the five questions that of what the state really wanted to offer Moore's testimony for. And that would have, that's Pendleton, I think that would have here would have cured any problem we have with all this wide-ranging, I would say it's testimony that was used to corroborate or was not impeachment, but bolstering his testimony, or he tried to use to bolster his testimony and to try and point make the stronger case that Collins was actually the shooter in this case. So we'd ask for the conviction to be reversed.
Thank you both, counsel. Very good oral argument and briefing as well. We always appreciate that from both of you. We'll be issuing our opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you both.